Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 19th. Today's session is entitled Geologic Hazards, Life in an Uncertain World, presented by Rose McKinney. Let's listen in.
I'm ready to start now. My name is Rose McKinney, and this is the second in a series. It's titled Life in an Uncertain World with Geologic Hazards, and mostly I was planning on focusing on earthquakes, volcanoes, and floods. And please, at any time if you have questions, feel free to interrupt me. If I don't know the answer, I will say so, because I don't know everything there is to know about this planet we live on. Sorry. I try, but I just don't have it all down yet. I'm working on it. So I thought that we would start with earthquakes. And this is just an earthquake hazard map. And you notice that there are no earthquake hazards in Canada. There are also none in Mexico. I have to laugh because the weather does the same thing. There isn't any in Canada. But you'll see, if you look at this, that the red is the highest earthquake hazard, which means the West Coast, especially California and Oregon and Washington, and it actually goes fairly far inboard, both in California and Washington. But then you'll see the Rockies, and then there's that mysterious bullseye pattern in southern Missouri as well. Does anyone have any questions about why this pattern would be?
Yeah.
Okay, what kind of questions do you have?
Yeah, the bullseye.
The bullseye.
Because I remember there's no tectonic plate.
Right. There is no tectonic plate edge there. There is, however, a big fault there called the Madrid Seismic Zone. And we know that it's active because in the late 1800s, it let go with what is probably the largest earthquake that's been experienced in the recorded history of the United States. And so it, fortunately for that area of the country, it tends to have an earthquake about once every 800 years or so maybe we'll be fine for quite a while. And we really don't have a good explanation for why the inboard areas in the United States actually have so many earthquakes. It's kind of unusual. They should be on the margin on the West Coast because that is where the active tectonics is. But as the plates shift and move, some of the tension actually builds up in the center of the country, and apparently over a long period of time from a human perspective, 800 years, a short period of time from a geologic perspective, that enough tension will build up inside the continent. Sort of like if you pull on both edges of a piece of paper, you're actually pulling on the edge, but there's stress that builds up in the middle. We think that that's the same sort of thing that's going on. We don't have a really good explanation. Yeah.
South Carolina, what's going on there?
It's the same sort of, the thing is that the east coast of the United States used to, long ago, and probably also far away, be attached to Europe. And one of the things that happens is the old tectonic collisions leave a lot of faults behind. And so all those old faults are still in the east coast, even though they're usually quiet. Any stress that builds up will be released along the fault if it happens to be positioned in the right direction. And apparently Missouri and South Carolina just happen to have faults in the right position. And by the way, some of the ones in New York are underneath some of the nuclear reactor facilities, which as geologists on the East Coast, we always felt was really a positive thing. Not! I'm kidding. Any other questions?
Is that the red area inland is Yellowstone?
That's in the Yellowstone and in the Rockies, the Central Rockies.
Which way is the continent moving? The North American continent?
North American continent is sort of roughly moving westward, and it is moving over the Pacific Ocean plate, over the Guadalupe plate, which is okay, and that is actually. Of course, all of this is happening because of plate tectonics. Just in case anybody wants a refresher here, this is a nice little wedge of the Earth, complete with the plate diving down. And somebody asked me yesterday, the plate the ocean plates almost always go below because they're a little bit denser than the continental material. Yeah. And so fortunately, they go down. If you have two ocean plates colliding, it's a contest. And one side wins and gets to be on, up above, and one, I guess, I don't know. They like to be recycled. But so the ocean plate will go down, and then in that area where it says deep ocean trench, that would be off the coast of Washington. And we can see how that would look. This is the local sort of picture. And the trench would be associated with the line that says Cascadia subduction zone. And that plate is heading down. It forms lots of nice earthquakes, both deep, which is several in the hundred of kilometers beneath the surface is a deep earthquake. Other ones are up higher and are shallow. And something that was actually found after this diagram was put together is a little thing called the Seattle Fault. And I'll get back to that. It happens to be pretty important in terms of hazards.
Questions. Yeah. So will eventually, because you've got the Pacific Plate moving one way and you've got, Washington's plate moving this way over top of Juan de Fuca. So eventually Juan de Fuca will no longer be there, right?
Right. It is just a small chip, and there's also another chip well to the south called the Cocos Plate. They're just the little bits that are left of a much larger plate called the Farallon Plate. And the Farallon Plate has been moving underneath the North American Plate for at least 40 million years. And I sort of base that on, there's a kink in the Hawaiian Island Emperor Seamount chain, and it's about 40 million years ago, and that is assumed to be there because the plate collision started off at the coast of...
Does that mean yes, one of people will not be there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sorry. That was a long-winded answer. Yes, it is going bye-bye. And now, in terms of how fast it's going by, plates move between 2 and 20 centimeters a year, and the North American plate is moving about as fast as your fingernails are growing, so it's going to be a while yet, but it is going away. Other questions? Like you said, geologic time is impossible to deal with. So if we're looking at hazards in the Northwest, all these little dots are magnitude earthquake 3 and greater in the area from northern Oregon up into southern BC. And, you know, do you notice anything about that pattern? Like, about where is the pattern the heaviest?
Yeah.
Southern Puget Sound, okay? That also happens to coincide with a lot of people live here. One of the wonders of hazards, that there's a lot of people in that area that's have got a lot of black dots. And when we look at the deeper earthquakes, it's not quite as bad. They're more toward the western, toward the peninsula side, but it's still...
You live there.
I know. It's not as concentrated on the population, but these deep earthquakes, as people who were in the Seattle area in 2001 know, actually do, in this case, the Nisqually earthquake was centered in South Sound area. And the people who lived there were really lucky because it was a magnitude anywhere from 6.5 to 7.1, depending on when you listen, but they kind of finally settled on 6.8. which is a fairly large earthquake, and yet it really didn't do that much damage. Part of that is the Northwest had woken up at one point and said, you know, we might have an earthquake problem, it's not just California. And the other one was, it was a deep earthquake, and by the time it hit the surface, some of the energy, it actually wasn't really close to the origin, and so it had spread out, rather like waves in a pond do. If you're at the margin, it's not quite so bad as you're right in the middle where the rock hits. Okay, and so we have just talk about some of the hazards, and please remember to interrupt me if you have any questions. The first thing that comes to most people's mind is that the Earth is moving, and in fact what this person is measuring is the offset after the road has split, and it's very neat and tidy. You have the straight line down the middle of the road, the Earth shakes and splits, and then you can just take your ruler out and measure how far that offset was. Another thing that people sometimes don't think about that is actually a pretty major problem is something we call liquefaction. And these are from different earthquakes. It's not all one earthquake. But what happens if you can imagine a bunch of pieces of sediment that were sort of egg-shaped, so they're sort of long and thin. And if they're all stacked so that they're long, thin, they were stacked on top of each other, long, thin to long, thin, so that you have them taking up the maximum amount of space that they could. They're not sitting down in between. There's not one egg sitting down in between the place where the two meet. When the Earth shakes, all those eggs sort of rearrange and settle. And at the time they're rearranging and settling, some of the stress of that shaking is actually on the water that is between. And the Earth sort of goes through this I'm not really solid thing. And when the Earth isn't really solid, the bridge or the road or the building that was built on that once solid ground loses its foundation support. And so we see road collapse, bridge collapse, buildings roll over, and fun stuff like that.
Where's that one on the bottom right corner? That's what that means.
Bottom right corner, I think that is from one of the, the bottom right corner is a Japanese earthquake, and it's not Kobe, but I can't pronounce the name of it. It was prior to that, I think, in the 60s. And just a few more scenes of what liquefaction can do. I wouldn't have wanted to be on that road. Not even slightly.
Is it kind of like the earth underneath is almost hyperplaning on that level of water?
It actually is.
Can you repeat the questions?
Oh, I'm sorry. She was asking if the earth was hydroplaning on a layer of water. Actually, what it is that if you have a lot of sediment and water mixed together and you shake it, then actually the net strength is the strength of the water. And water isn't very strong to things that go through it, and so to waves that actually shear through it. And so what you're seeing is the effect of having built something on something that for a moment has the strength of water.
Hmm. Rose, the most damage done in the Nisqually earthquake was in the Pioneer Square area.
Yeah, the fill area.
Mm-hmm. Same thing in the Marina District in San Francisco. It gets shaken and it just goes to look.
Yeah.
Redondo Beach during the Northridge.
Which brings me to a question of why we think that in earthquake-prone areas we can reclaim the land from the water. I'm a little concerned about that tendency personally, and I wouldn't want to live somewhere in a building that was built on fill.
Unless you figure that you're going to move away in 30 years and then it's somebody else's problem.
As long as you're lucky. Okay, another thing that...
we're really familiar with this one.
This is also from the Nisqually earthquake, and landsliding is common. In the Northridge earthquake in 1994, there were approximately 10 to 20,000 landslides associated with that earthquake. And so it's not just liquefaction or the shaking of the ground in a localized area, but when the ground shakes, any piece of land that is, a little iffy in terms of how stable it is can come tumbling down. And then, of course,
the structures that are on top of them go to
Where is this picture at?
I think it was called Johnson Road in Olympia. And it is part. Yeah, it is part of the Nisqually earthquake damage. Mm-hmm. And as I said, that was really minimal damage from that earthquake for its magnitude. So, what we try to do as geologists is, and this is from the Bay Area because the Bay Area has been mapped. Seattle's not quite so far along, but we'll get. And so just how much shaking is likely to happen at the surface for an earthquake? And it's based a lot on what type of material there is. So the moderately and low, so the sort of pale blue and blue-gray, and then the dark gray around, are either far enough away, that's the dark gray around the margin, or they're very hard rocks that aren't likely to cause the shaking of the earth to amplify near the surface. And by amplify, I mean it's sort of like if you take a plate with a block of Jell-O on it. This worked better in North Dakota. Jell-O is a very common. It's a little less common. Excuse me, all of Minnesota. But if you take a plate with a block of Jell-O on it and shake it, you know, the Jell-O at the top really starts going a lot faster than the plate that you're shaking. And that's the same sort of thing that soft sediment does. A rigid block of wood, if you shake it, it shakes just as fast as you shake it. It doesn't shake faster at the top. So that's kind of a way to picture what we're doing is we're mapping the rocks and saying it's not likely to shake faster, or it is. And you notice that the extremely high areas are right around the water, where the rivers will dump sediment or humans have dumped sediment to build out into the water. And then there are also some high areas along the river systems as well. And another thing we'll do is take a look at that liquefaction. It's a smaller area that is very high and high. And in this case, it is almost always right around the water. And that's because liquefaction is very common when we have soft sediment that is very water rich. And so it really requires the water. You can see the pattern of the drainage there. And if you read the little side too, you know, notice that they're saying more detailed maps are needed for site development decisions. This is a generalized map. This is the weaseling of, to make sure that nobody can sue them for their map. Okay, oops, I lied. And so they're starting to do this for Seattle, and they have a multiple layer system that they're putting together in the Seattle area. This is the topography, and you notice that little blue line. What they've said is looking at the topography, we see that there's a pretty steep break in the slope. There's a gentle slope near the water, there's a fairly gentle slope at the top of the hill, but in between we have that steep slope. We think that might be a scarp. And then we want to know what the materials are like there. And so we're going to map the geology, or soil types in this case. It's sort of a hybrid soil type geology map, actually. And we're very concerned about what kind of materials might be there, especially things like the Vashon clay. Okay, we're back to that sediment idea again. The till is up high and is a mix of materials, and so it's probably not too much of a problem. The outwash is actually probably sorted sand and gravel and is less of an issue than the clay might be. And then when they put that together, they'll put the buildings on top, and then we get questions, as one of the graduate students at the University of Washington asked me, she says, "You're a geologist? Should we buy earthquake insurance?" I don't know where you live. I have no idea what the building's like. I don't know. So I gave her some ideas and questions, like, has somebody done a map? Find out what it's like in the area before you make that decision. So, Rose, these are actual buildings, and this is West Seattle?
This is actually West Seattle, and those would be the houses and apartment buildings and facilities in the area.
So it's just like down here on Alki?
Yeah. I think so, yeah. I'm not the best
south of the lighthouse.
Detailed
that would be
Seattle geography once you get out of the U district.
Yes. So what are you saying as far as Vashon Island and earthquakes?
Oh, I was just saying the Vashon clay, which was a layer there. And I don't, the details of Vashon Island, that I have to have the geology to see that.
So they're not necessarily related?
Vashon is a... Geologists name the rocks and soil types sort of the way we name people. And so each different geologic unit has a name, and the Vashon name is used because it's a local name, and probably the soil or the rock was described on Vashon. Or associated, in this case, there's a Vashon glaciation, and so all of the materials that are associated with that glaciation carry that name.
So Vashon doesn't necessarily have Vashon clay?
Not necessarily. It may, but I don't know one way or the other. Okay. One of the other things that we would want to know is how intense or how extreme is the damage going to be? And there's a difference between energy release and damage. Energy released can be measured several ways. The most commonly known one is the Richter scale. But this instead is a Mercalli scale, talking about how much damage each area receives. And so in the Bay Area, once again, that damage is concentrated. This is for the 1906 earthquake. Its damage is concentrated around the bay and then along the fault, along the straight fault area. All right. Any other questions about earthquakes? Yeah.
I just wanted to point out that there's a website that you can look at that tell you all about the current earthquakes and where they are.
Right, the USGS maintains sites, and then also some of those sites are mirrored at local universities, like the University of Washington mirrors, or they actually work together, and so the information is shared back and forth. And the same is also true with the California universities. I'm just not quite as familiar with it. So one of the things they do like to know is if you are in an earthquake, what you felt, what kind of damage your house has sustained. That way they can create a map like this for each individual earthquake. And that gives them more information to go back and tell us more about future earthquakes. We really don't have a way to predict when an earthquake is going to happen, regardless of what anyone might have said otherwise. There are only ways to sort of tell what's likely.
Isn't this used by your insurance company to rate your home?
Yes. That, and I would assume that they would also want to know how it was made.
Right.
But it doesn't tell you when the earthquake is going to happen or if or how big it's going to be. None of those things can we really tell with any certainty at the moment. Yeah.
I came in just a little late. Did you talk about the frequency of earthquakes as far as the history and what do you feel is happening at this point?
Oh, I forgot to mention that. Thank you for asking. So I don't know too much of the details about California. It just seems like it always has earthquakes from my perspective. But in the Seattle area, a magnitude 6 to 7 earthquake happens about every 30 to 40 years. And in fact, prior to the 2001 earthquake, the last major one had been in 1965. So it was, 36 years from one to the next major earthquake. And then they say, in addition to that, there are very large magnitude 8 and 9 earthquakes. Those recur probably every 300 to 500 years in the Seattle area. And the last one was about 300 years ago.
300.
So, and very recently, cutting across Seattle, they found the Seattle Fault, and that, they feel, has potential for 7, possibly 8 magnitude earthquakes, and it goes right through the city. In addition to that, and I forgot to mention this earlier, Seattle is a basin, and so like the bay, it actually magnifies the shaking of the earthquake. So that heavy population center, the largest number of earthquakes, and it magnifies them, all piled on top of each other.
So don't send your kid to UW, is that what you're
Go
saying?
Mariners.
Well, in answer to that question, in North Dakota, whenever I taught about earthquakes, volcanoes, and all that stuff, they're like, I was going to move to California, but I'm just too scared to now. Well, it turns out that the geologic hazard that causes the most human death is floods. And the natural disaster that causes the most human death and destruction are hurricanes. So, you choose. I'll leave the decision up to you, but those are sort of your choices in terms of frequency and hazard. Okay. So, I just want to, at this point, read just a little bit. This is a book, Natural Grace. It's about it's a collection of William Dietrich's columns from the Seattle PI. And in his introduction, he talks a little bit about his view of the Northwest and how it's changed through his life. And he said that in the past, when he was young, that the outdoors was scenery, background wallpaper for an urban life. Witnessing the eruption of Mount St. Helens in 1980 while I was working at the Vancouver Columbian upset any assumptions I had about the permanence of nature. And so I think a lot of the awareness of how nature changes and the hazards we lived with in the Northwest actually started in 1980. Really, floods, we could deal with that. But how unstable the ground underneath our feet was really became clear right about this time. And just to give you an idea of how far that volcanic band stretches, it comes from southern BC into northern California. It sort of skips a little bit in this area in northern Washington through the Cascades. There's still a couple of volcanoes, but it's not really in the center of the volcanic hazard. And Mount Rainier is considered to be one of the most hazardous volcanoes, despite the fact that, and this is a recap, this happens because the plate goes down and it melts. Even though Mount St. Helens has more eruptions over the last 4,000 years, and even though Mount Hood is close to Portland, Rainier is viewed as being one of the most dangerous because it has a tendency to let loose with mud flows and where those mud flows go, and I'll get back to that. You can see that the volcanoes are just a bit active over time, all of them as a group. Mount St. Helens has the most activity, followed by Shasta. And around 200 years ago, all of them went through a little eruption zone. It's not really clear why. I'd love to be able to say it. It was because of this, because then I'd be famous. But I don't know the answer.
Mount Baker appears to be active. It's giving off steam all the time, and yet it doesn't look from that.
Yeah, so. The Mount Baker and Mount Adams have both been through this little steam game that they play. So they get kind of steamy, and everybody's like, they're going to erupt, and then nothing happens. And then they do it all over again. And still, there's really not much. And it may be that that steaming actually lets enough pressure off, though I don't understand quite how that would be, because we're talking about a huge amount of pressure in one of these explosive eruptions. So these are just some, when we're talking about explosive eruptions, we actually classify them based on how large the explosion is, and that explosion actually is determined by the kind of rock that's melted, how much water and carbon dioxide and other things that we call volatiles are mixed in with the molten rock, and then also how much confining pressure the magma, the area surrounding the rock can actually contain. Really explosive eruptions occur because there's a lot of gas mixed up in with the magma, and you take and you shake your bottle of soda, pop the top off, it goes everywhere. If you replace the liquid soda with something really, really, really thick, it's going to spatter everywhere and be quite a mess. And that's what's happening here. The composition of the rock, basalts tend to melt at higher temperatures and be kind of loose and fluid as rock goes, and so they're less likely to have explosive eruptions. So the eruptions on the islands of Hawaii, for example, are pretty calm because those islands are made out of basalt. The type of material found in the Cascades, there's some basalt, and then there's also andesite, which has a little more silica in it, which means the melted rock is thicker and less likely to flow. And they actually go all the way up to rhyolites, which are very the thickest, most silica-rich rocks. And so we end up with pretty explosive eruptions as a result of the composition of the lava and the amount of gas in. Do you have any questions about this sort of summary of what bad things happen when a volcano erupts? Do you want to talk about the mud flows? Sure. Mud flows, or lahars, are usually occur in a situation like Mount St. Helens, where you have a nice water source. In the case of Mount St. Helens, thick packs of ice, you heat that up, get a lot of water rapidly. There was a lot of loose debris on the surface, and the mud goes flying down the side of the mountain. They can be rapid. They're not necessarily, it's not unusual for them to move at 30 miles an hour. They're usually pretty thick. So it's not like stream flow where you can see where it moves like water. It's actually thicker. It can be as thick as concrete or thinner and soupier. The thicker it is, the better it is at rafting large objects like boulders. And let me just take a look and get there. So here we have some nice pictures of mud flows. This is Muddy Bridge, and it took the bridge out in the upper picture, and the lower picture is there's four people there, and you can see how large the boulders are that are scattered across the surface. They're much larger than, well, they're about the size of all four people and then a little bit. And so usually those large boulders are actually rafted because there's so much sediment in the water that those boulders float on the mud flow.
So if, like, Rainier is, were to erupt, you would get mud flows from Rainier, but wouldn't it also be likely to spark earthquakes? I mean,
yeah,
probably it, when that happens, you're going to get a combination of things.
You get a combination of things. The reason why Mount Rainier is viewed as being a problem because of the mud flows is the mapped mud flows from the past. There are
go right to typical.
What?
Don't they go right to Tacoma?
Oh, they go through Tacoma and Auburn and a few other places. Yeah, I have a map of that. And so, yeah, this whole range from lava to pyroclastic flows. And the difference between a mud flow and a pyroclastic flow is the pyroclastic flow is actually the original eruption. It's a mix of hot rock and other material, the hot rock and steam and gas. And so in addition to moving quickly and having quite a bit of power, it's also hot enough to kill you as well. So it, you get to be rolled over and baked at the same time. And then, I'm just looking for the thing that I was going to... So to answer your question about the mud flows, these are the mud flows from Mount Rainier, and so the Mount Rainier can actually send mud flows almost... The Nisqually River runs between Tacoma and Olympia, so they're a ways down almost to Olympia, and then up in the Renton area. And that whole lower area in the Ording, Puyallup, Enumclaw, Auburn area is easily inundated by lahars. I mean, and so the mud flows are a serious threat to a lot of people in the greater Seattle-Tacoma area that goes all the way to Commencement.
I'm
going to
go back to where I was before.
Okay, and lahars don't always have to be right along with the eruption. They continue at long after the eruption is over because we have all this loose material that's around, that's been erupted around the area, and then the local drainage system, the rivers, get blocked off sometimes, and that's what happened in this before picture. A local creek was blocked by some sediment, and a big lake built up, and then it let go. And so it's not unusual for lahars to destroy whole towns, bury them. And you can see that the building, it gives you an idea of how much material there is. That whole building is buried right up to its roof. And this was in the Philippines.
Can you point out the water that was dammed up by sediment?
Just a second.
What was the question?
She wants to know about the water being dammed by the sediment here, and I just was going to... So... We have the area way back there. It's not very, this is the foreground, just that thin stripe up there in the background is the forward edge of the water. Okay. And then it came out. So the water's actually way in the background and it ran forward over the town.
That's along with all the water and mud?
Is the water is being dammed up. But when the water was released, it took all of the sediment in front of it with it and then filled the whole foreground with mud.
Wow.
Okay. Not always, but sometimes we also get the blast damage that we had at Mount St. Helens as well. I just always, I remember going up there as a geology student and was sort of shocked by the way the trees looked like somebody come by with a comb and combed them. And so I had to just show it one more time. So what do we do about living next door to these things? We actually have a better chance with volcanoes in terms of keeping ourselves safe and knowing what's going to happen than we do with earthquakes. Because we can use a variety of tools, and they tend to give off warning signals ahead of time. So those the chemistry, the gas that they're erupting will change. A lot of times there'll be an increase in the amount of sulfur. We can determine that by putting in, they're starting to be able to sense that remotely so that nobody has to go up and actually measure the gas. They can take a look at how the ground is changing by actually going out and measuring it, looking at lake levels if there happens to be a lake there. Then we also keep track of the hydrology for a check on lahars. And the other thing we do is seismic monitoring. When magma starts to move upward, it really won't fit very well into the space because the Earth is pretty tightly held down. There's not huge cracks underground. And so there's a lot of pressure from that upward moving magma, and eventually it exerts enough pressure that the ground breaks. And when it does that, it registers on seismographs. And so one of the things that they'll keep track of is whether or not there are a lot of these earthquakes or harmonic tremors. And if there are a lot of harmonic tremors and the chemistry is shifted and the ground is starting to deform, all things that happened before Mount St. Helens erupted, then we worry about it and they start to evacuate people these days.
Yeah. What about the awareness in the Philippine Lahar? Was there that awareness of what was going on? Or?
I'm not sure about that individual Lahar, but for the actual main eruption of Mount Pinatubo, they had been keeping an eye on it and been pretty concerned. Mount Pinatubo was sort of grumbling a lot, and they finally decided that they had to evacuate, and then it erupted a few days later. Because there was Clark Air Force Base was there, and they were very concerned about it. And so they pulled everybody out. Okay, one thing that is a hazard from both volcanoes and earthquakes and also from landslides are tsunamis. And this is just an old photo from Hilo in 1946. They're very, very large waves that are associated with movement of the ground or explosion where you're in the ocean setting. And it's an issue. They're concerned, as I said, about the Seattle Fault. And so NOAA did this modeling. The Seattle Fault cuts across Seattle and out actually into the Sound. And so this is a model that has some assumptions built in. I believe they used a magnitude 7 earthquake on the Seattle Fault. And they decided to put the rupture, for those of you who are familiar with this area, at the edge of Bainbridge Island, so the earthquake's actually happening out in the Sound off the edge of the picture. And you see that the top picture says start. The second one says 30 seconds, and that light blue area is the crest of the wave. And then at 2 minutes, the crest of the wave has come all the way in and hit that upper highland is Magnolia Bluff, and then it's swept all the way in the mouth of the Duwamish River, which is that lower area, and it happens to be where the sports stadiums are, and also the industrial area, the lower industrial area in Seattle. So you can see that if there were to be a break in the Seattle Fault that was actually out in the Sound, it would take very little time for a tsunami to come rolling right in to the lower areas of Seattle. That's the hypothesis anyway. I don't really want to test that. Does anyone have any other questions about volcanoes? Okay. The last thing I'd like to talk about is near and dear to my heart. I actually have a background having worked for the U.S. Geological Survey Water Resources Division in Missouri, and I was in Missouri in 1993 when the Missouri-Mississippi rivers flooded, and again in 1995 when the Missouri River flooded again. So I kind of, it's harrowing when you're living through it, but it's really interesting geologically. And the major hazard, of course, from flooding is that everything gets wet. But what people don't often think about, and was really clear during the Missouri-Mississippi floods, is that we sometimes have erosion happening as well, large amounts of erosion. In that flood, in the area, the larger area around St. Louis, there were sometimes erosion holes that opened up 60 feet deep. You know, it's your farm field, and you now have a 60-foot hole in it, or it's your farm field and you have, 6 feet of sand on it, it's a serious issue. And also erosion in that particular flood took out a lot of houses. So people didn't just have to clean up their homes. Their home just went downstream in lots of little pieces. So there's a lot of power in some floods. And I just want to take you quickly through a series of photos of Oregon City. It's on the Willamette River in Oregon. And I just kind of want you to keep track of the dates. This one's 1890. Then we have 1923, 1943, and 1996. And actually, they asked the question at the Oregon Trail Interpretive Center, should we have built this in a floodplain? Well, we didn't have much choice. This is where the Oregon Trail ends. And they ended it in a floodplain. But you can see that it's sort of an issue in that particular area.
Has it been getting worse?
And that's a good question. Are floods getting worse? Well, there are some things. Floods are a natural cause of having too much water in too small of a channel. And they're common. Normally in the low flow situation, the water's all inside the channel. We also have a higher flow situation that occurs every couple of years where the channel is completely full of water, but it's still within the banks. And then it heads out probably every 2 to 5 years. Most rivers will actually have a flood that comes outside of the banks naturally. And then at some point we get out to the area that's only underwater, on average, one time in 100 years. But, I know it's not quite that way. Statistically,
that 100-year storm could happen.
Twice, it's 2 years in a row.
2 years in a row. Mm-hmm. Every year is
but
the same
over
year.
A long period of time, it would be underwater.
But you know, and that is also spatially distributed, so that in the Seattle area, you could have a 100-year storm in Issaquah, but not in
right.
Rent. And so you get the idea you're always having 100-year storms or such and such storms.
Yeah, it's done on each river system and on each site at a river system. So you can have a 100-year flood at one site and not at another one. There could be one at Puyallup on the Puyallup River, but not at Ording or not at Tacoma. They're all in the same river.
With,
so Ording
is
still doing that.
The reason I guess is engineers frequently get the question, why do we have 3 years with 25-year storms, and you know, how can that happen?
Because you had a huge, and the answer to that, as Brian knows, is that you can have 75 years with no floods that ever go out of the banks, or it's possible, and you're just looking at, on average, over a very long period of time. But to answer the question about are the floods happening more frequently, well, we have a little bit of control over how the water actually gets to the stream. And one of the things that we've done in urbanized areas is we've built buildings, we have a lot of roads, and water, all the water when it rains then will run off the top of a roof of a building or off of a street. And that means that all of the water goes into the channel rather than some of it soaking into the ground. And we end up with more water in the river system. And funny that somebody asked about Orting. I love Orting. It's a wonderful geologic hazard town. It has a river on one side, a river on the other side, and a volcano uphill. It's just great. In fact, I was talking to somebody who was teaching in New Zealand, and I said, oh, you know, there's this town, it's called Orting. He goes, I know, we use it in class. Oh, boy. So, one of the things that we try to do, and this is done for insurance purposes, and it's also something that if you're going to buy a house, you might want to pay attention to. They do map out the 100 and 500 year floodplains. So areas that we would expect, you know, a flood with a recurrence interval of 100 years to be underwater, or with one of 500 years to be underwater. Now, both of these rivers in the Orting area have what we call dikes on them, which means that they're supposedly protected from floods. But dikes are built based on a certain recurrence interval flood. So they're only good up to whatever that recurrence interval is.
Well, one other hazard with the dikes is where the water used to spread out, now it's contained in a little channel, so it has to get higher to carry the same amount of water out.
Right, and the other hazard of that is if the banks are completely full up to near the top of the dike, there's a lot of pressure on the dike, and there's also a lot of elevation down the side. When the dike goes, you not only have a lot of water, but you have a lot of erosive power, and that's actually part of what happened in the Missouri-Mississippi floods. The whole length of the Missouri-Mississippi in the Missouri area, the state of Missouri and parts of the states upstream, is channelized like that, and there's nowhere for the water to go but up.
Or
as I watched one time, the dike just breaks and the fish and the water come flopping out into the road, and then pretty soon you have this gigantic waterfall pouring out onto the land, and you get some pretty big erosion holes at the same time. It's impressive to watch one. It's very interesting to watch one break. So one of the things I just wanted to sort of present, there is a solution to this urbanization and water flow problem that some people are trying. It's still experimental. It won't work everywhere, and it has to have, as Brian would I'm sure agree, you have to be very careful about how you put this in. But this is an area in Seattle where they went through and they redid the streets with a low impact development idea. What they did is they narrowed the paved street, they curved it. That's more of a traffic control issue than it is a water flow issue. And then they took, and instead of having highs of vegetation on each side of the street, they sunk those down. So the water, when it flows off the street, flows into a swale. The first, and they chose this particular area because it's a small watershed, and they can keep track of the water coming, going in and coming out without trying to figure out how much of it is because of this, that, and the other. It's this one neighborhood.
There's a park in Greenwood that they just built, where in addition to things like that, wherever there's a sidewalk or a paved area, they use the porous concrete so the water goes in rather than flows.
And I think these, I'm not sure if these sidewalks are that same way or not.
Probably in the Seattle area they are, because you're on that outwash. When you have porous pavement, the water goes through the pavement, but it needs to go somewhere after that. So you need to have some
More of it soaking into the ground.
Right. Well, yeah, so you need the outwash soils are common in some places in Seattle. But I couldn't do this in Bellingham, most places in Bellingham, because it's clay.
You'd have to dig out all of the soil too and put something else underneath it. Yeah. And then at some point you still have the same sort of problem. There was about an 8-inch rainstorm beforehand, before they changed the area, and then about a 9-inch rainstorm afterwards. So the rainstorm was about the same size. There was a 98% decrease in runoff from before and after. So that was a very positive thing, and as a result, this area will have a lot less, will contribute far less to the flooding problems in the Seattle area.
Did they have any difficulties with basement flooding or
not
seepage?
That I know of.
People in Seattle have basements?
Some people in Seattle do have basements.
Most of that rich is
sandy. Nobody in Vancouver is a basement.
Oh, really? Huh. No, people in Seattle have basements. Some of them have daylight basements.
Yeah, there's a lot of hillsides.
So, thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, that's my final word.